For context, I'll just tell you a little bit about myself and then we'll get started. I'm the general director of the Independent Education Program. That's a educational program that operates online and it looks like we're all getting the same public safety message. Take a look at this. It's an endangered missing person. We'll be socially conscious, let you take a look at it and then Green 98 Ford F-150. Okay, great. All right, my name is Sam Martineau. I'm the director of the Independent Education Program. We operate on the Wasatch Front. We also have classes that are online. I personally teach debate classes. It started as a debate program. It's expanded to, our debate program has about 500 kids in it. They debate each other. It's a lot of fun. We do Model United Nations and mock trial. If you want to know more about that, you can talk to me later. But more or less, I've been teaching in the homeschooling community for years. And we encompass, I have probably taught thousands of kids at this point. And over the years, I teach 300 kids this year. And we have about 700 kids in the program altogether. Altogether, it's going well, and that's who I am. So I want to begin by asking you to define something for me. So if you could just write this down, if you have note-taking materials. If not, you could just do it in your head. I'd like you to define three words for me, and I'm going to ask you to do something really specific. So listen carefully, because it's going to sound like I'm asking you to do something generic and normal, but I'm asking for something very specific and the wording matters. So here it is. Would you please write down the highest quality definition that you can think of for the following three words: moral, competent, rational. Say that again. Moral, just write these down. Competent, rational. Just take a minute to write down the highest quality definition that you can think of. Those who walked in, we're just doing a, thanks for coming by the way, doing a small activity. If you have note-taking materials, I'm asking everyone to write down the best, highest quality definition they can think of for the words moral, competent, and rational. What does it mean to be moral? What does it mean to be competent? What does it mean to be rational? If you want to keep thinking about that, you can keep writing if there's time, but I'll just start telling you a story while you finish that up. And some of you are done, some of you not, so I'll do a story. So years ago, I want to tell you about a student that I taught, and I think you'd be familiar with this student. It's, I think, someone that we've all encountered and someone that our children have been at points. So I taught him years ago when I was a pretty young teacher, and I had a pretty different perspective on teaching. And this kid, I mean, I could not stand him. And it's embarrassing for me to say that, honestly. It's actually really sad for me to say that. I think back about this kid, and I feel terrible about how I felt. I feel terrible about what I thought about him. But he wore black from head to toe every day, except for his white tennis shoes. So he had these white tennis shoes, and he wore black jeans, and then a black shirt, and then he slicked his hair back. And he had just this black button-up shirt that he would wear and kind of like pop the collar up. And he would sit in the back of classes, and he would like gather his group of guys to him, you know. And I would say something, and then they'd be like, you know, in the corner. You know what I'm talking about, yes? You've met this kid. Your child has been this kid at certain points. And resistant, angry, and above all, he did not care. And he did not, I mean, and you had to know that he did not care. Hey, how you feeling about the class? Oh, you think I care about this class? Well, how silly of you. You understand the point. And I just thought this kid was a jerk. And I was like, why did I get landed with this kid? Throughout the years, I've learned a lot that's changed the way that I've interacted with students. It's changed the way that I've seen them, and it's changed my ability to connect with them. I don't think I did a whole lot of good for him at all, and I regret that deeply. Honestly, I think I could reach him now. I think I could have done things for him. And my presentation today is basically an argument that we change the way that we see children. In the same way that I changed the way that I see him. You know, I saw him then as a problem kid, a jerk, maladjusted, someone who was just a nuisance. And I look at kids like that now. I see hurt kids. I see scared kids. I see alone kids. And it's changed the way that I interact with them. It's changed my ability to reach them. So I'd like to sort of take you through the transformation in that thinking. There's a really interesting study. It was, it was published in the Journal of Experimental Social Psychology in 2020. And it took place in Norway and the United States. There were about 1,500 participants. And it's called Sour Grapes or Greener Grass. And it addresses these two colloquialisms that we have to describe how you feel about things that you don't think you can get. One is the grass is greener on the other side. So that says if you don't think you can get something, then you are going to value it more because the grass is greener on the other side than your own side. And then there's sour grapes, Aesop's fable of the fox and the grapes, and he can't get the grapes. So he's like, oh, well, those are probably just sour grapes. And so that's like, well, if you aren't going to be able to get something, then you're going to devalue that. And so this study wanted to test the hypothesis, which one is more true. So what they did is they did it in six different variations, and each variation was a little bit different, but here's the basic structure. They take people and say, we're going to have you take two tests, which was a lie. They were only going to have them take one. They lied through the whole thing. It was like, this is what studies do, right? You lie to people and then see how they react to the lies. So they said, you're going to take two tests, and instead they had them take one. And then they said, we are going to test, there were the specific words, I want to make sure I get these words right. Yes, we're going to test your intuitive intelligence. That was not true. They weren't testing intuitive intelligence at all. There's no test for intuitive intelligence. And they said, we're going to test, in other variations, your mental agility. Is the same thing? Are we getting messages again? Is that what's happening? Okay, gotcha. All right. So they said, we're going to test your mental agility. And just so you know, studies have shown that mental agility is highly correlated with future life success. That was also a lie. No such thing as mental agility. No test for it. Whatever. But they said that because they wanted people to value the test, to say, okay, well, this is going to tell me important information about this. Then they said, they had to take the test, and they said, here are your results. That was a lie also. Well, some of the variations. Some of the variations, they told them how they actually did on the test that they took. Some of them, they just lied. They were like, oh, you did terrible, even if they did great. Oh, you did wonderful, even if they did poorly, right? Just to make sure, just to see what would happen if they were lying, if they were telling the truth. And then, so that's the independent variable in this study. It is, what's your score? And then, the dependent variable is how they answer this question. How happy would you be if you got a great score the second time that you took the test, and then later they found out actually you're not taking the test the second time? You see how that would test the question. If you got a score that was low the first time, and therefore you thought you were likely to get a score that was low the second time, would you rate your satisfaction at getting a good score the second time as lower than people who thought they were going to get a good score, or higher? Green grass, sour grapes. You understand the setup here. So let's take a shot here. What do you think it was? There was a consistent result across all six variations of the study. It was statistically significant. Do you think that people overvalued or undervalued the thing that they thought they couldn't get?
Undervalued.
The answer is, yeah, they undervalued it. It was consistent. They said, mental agility, who needs that? That's not even real, which was true, but they didn't know that. compared to people who thought they were going to do well the second time, they said, that would not affect my happiness much at all. And I wonder if that comports with what you see in your teenagers. I wonder if that comports with what you see in yourself sometimes, that you have an instinct to undervalue that. We'll talk about why, but maybe I can just share a couple examples here. I had a student, this is one of the first students who keyed me in to the fact that there were things that were happening in students' minds that I wasn't perceiving, and that if I would look closely, I would start to see students differently than I was seeing them. So I teach debate, and kids would come back from debate tournaments, and I would always ask, what did you learn at this tournament? And they would say, I was at that point when I was starting, I was just like, well, what did the judges tell you need to get better at? That's all I was asking. I had no idea the incredible things that they would tell me. And I have been told some really, really incredible things over the years. But this is one of the first ones. At a student, she was brilliant, super smart, thought she was working hard. And she came and she was like, Sam, here's what I learned at this tournament. I learned that I don't know. I don't want to know if I'm good at debate. I actually want to know if that's true. You see, for years, I've never actually prepared for a tournament. That was news to me, by the way. I had no idea that was true. I thought she was working real hard, you know, because she was doing relatively well. She's like, I've never really prepared. And I've always been like, well, why can't I get myself to prepare? I'm always like, next time I'm going to do it. You've all heard this, like, oh, but this time it's going to be different. I'm done with the procrastinating. And she's like, I finally figured out why I do that. Because, you see, I go to tournaments and I don't get ready and I get like 13th place. And I can always be like, well, I mean, I didn't even get ready and I got 13th place. So, properly understood, I'm probably the best one here. And I've always been able to tell this to myself. It's incredible. She was willing to say this to me. It was an extreme level of honesty. And she's like, yeah, I just have always been able to keep up that illusion. And I realized that that's the reason I'm prepared. Because if I go and I don't do it, but I tried really hard and then I got 13th place. That's just who I am. Seems crazy. Sabotaging, making sure that you do worse than you actually could. But this was real. This is her experience, what she was actually doing. I had another student. Tell you another story. This is another girl. Some years later, teaching in class, and this girl walks in, and every time I'm in class, she makes sure that I know, and everyone knows, that she does not want to be there. Walk in, time to get started. Oh, no. Do we really have to? I mean, I'm maybe hamming it up a little bit. Maybe. But it's just about just like that. Time to start a new activity. Oh, gosh. Do we really have to? Every week, I'd be like, it's time to get, okay, guys, time to wrap it up. And she'd be like, thank goodness. And at this point, I'd grown a little bit. If it had been earlier versions of me, maybe I would have said it, but I just wanted to be like, okay, we get it. We get the fact that you don't like the class. You don't have to keep saying it to us. We understood that weeks ago. You can stop. But at this point, I gained a little bit more patience for kids, so I just smiled and said, okay, and went forward. Here's the crazy thing. It was bullcrap. It wasn't true at all. She loved it. You got her in a debate, and she was like going back and forth until she saw you looking, and then she was like, hmm. It wasn't true at all. She liked the and you could see it. Like, I'd be discussing with kids going back and forth, and when she had something that she wanted to say, she'd like get out there and she'd say it, but she'd have to like play this dance for some reason. It was crazy. This is the question. Why the dance? Why is she pretending that she doesn't like something that she likes, in fact? And I think probably if you've had teenagers, you've all asked the same question. Why are they pretending that they don't like things that in fact they do like? Why are they pretending that they don't value things that they do in fact value? Why are they undervaluing things that in fact they value? Why is life all sour grapes? So, there's a really important, groundbreaking study that I think sheds some light on this issue. The groundbreaking study happens in, it's 1957, that's what it is, yeah. With Leon Fessinger. He's a professor at Stanford University. And he, if you're familiar with the concept of cognitive dissonance, his study is the origin point for the field of cognitive dissonance research. So this is one of the most robust, well-researched fields of psychology that there is. And it all starts with this study, and it's a really, really interesting study. So what he does is he takes students at Stanford University and he has them do a terribly boring task for an hour. Well, two terribly boring tasks, each for a half hour. The first one is they've got a tray, and they've got these discs on the tray, 48 discs, and they have to take the discs with one hand only, move them in the same pattern to a second tray, and then scoot the first tray to the other side, and then move them back onto the first tray, and then scoot the second tray to the side, and then put them back on the second tray. So they do that for half an hour, and then he gives them a square board with square pegs, 48 square pegs, and they have to start at the top left, pull it out, turn it quarter turn, move it, and they go through all the pegs, and then they do it again. And they have to do that for half hour. So they just spend an hour just with these terribly boring, mind-numbing, nobody's actually going to like these tasks. Now, that's not really where the study comes. The study is then, the independent variable is that here's what happens. You either get paid $1 or $20 to lie to the next person about how fun that task was. I told you this study is just about lies, right? Lie to them, see what happens. So they say, they're supposed to go to the next person and be like, oh yeah, that was fascinating. And you get paid $1 to do it or $2 to do it. The dependent variable in the study is that they then ask the person, well, how fun was that task really? And it turned out that there was a statistically significant difference between the people who got paid $1 to lie and the people who got paid $20 to lie. One of them said they liked the task more than the other. Anyone want to take any guesses? It was the $1. It seems weird, right? This is why it kicks off such a big branch of study, because the result is so unexpected. You would think you got paid $20 to lie, so you would like this experience better. But he said something else is going on in the human brain here, and here's this hypothesis, and the hypothesis is essentially cognitive dissonance. He says what's happening is that the people who got paid $1 are essentially saying to themselves, well, and just noting, $1 in 1957 is still not a lot, but $20 in 1957, that's a nice, I mean, that's a nice hour's work, right? So let's take, we'll take it from the $20 perspective. So people who got paid $20, they just got paid $20 to do something boring, and then they had to lie about it, and then they got a nice little reward, so worth it. But the people who got paid $1, they got paid $1 to do something super boring and then to lie. And so they're thinking, I'm a chump. Why on earth would I do that? Dissonance in their brain. They're like, I'm a chump. No, I'm not. I'm a smart person. No, you're a dummy. You just spent you got a dollar to do just nonsense. And then you had to lie about it. You're a dummy. And they said, no, I'm not. And they needed a way to resolve it. So then they said to themselves, well, maybe I'm not such a dummy. Because come to think of it, that was pretty fun. That was actually a pretty good time. You know, the pegs and everything, turning them. I mean, you had to pull it out of the hole. You had to turn it. And so forth. This is essentially the concept of cognitive dissonance. Cognitive dissonance is the idea that if a brain has to hold dissonant information inside the brain, then it needs to resolve it. It's the pain of having two ideas, both of which you think are legitimate, that are in contradiction to each other, and it causes a sort of intellectual pain inside of you. And I think you all understand what we're talking about here. When you come up against two ideas that are contradictory and you believe them both and you want to resolve them, that's cognitive dissonance. And cognitive dissonance holds some real insight as to why people choose sour grapes. Now, to help explain that, there's a follow-up paper. It's not actually its own research. It's by a professor named Elliot Aronson, and it's in 1969. So this is 12 years later. 12 years later, there's all this research that's pouring in on cognitive dissonance. Once Festinger did his study, people wanted to confirm it, so they did copycat studies and variations and all kinds of studies on cognitive dissonance, and the research is pouring in. And so Elliot Aronson does a review of the research, and he says, I think we're missing something on cognitive dissonance, and his hypothesis has since become groundwork, base-level ideas for cognitive dissonance. The idea is, he says, Festinger posited the idea, and we're all acting like the idea is, that dissonance is really strong when we get competing ideas in our mind. But that's not true, because sometimes you get competing ideas and they don't create the same results from dissonance. Sometimes people don't care that the ideas in their mind conflict. He said, he gave an example. He said, look, furthermore, I'll explain this first. He said, furthermore, we've been treating it like it's a logical inconsistency that's the problem, but it's not. It's a psychological inconsistency that's the problem. He says, there's this famous study that was a copycat study where you told a smoker that smoking causes cancer, and then they produced all the traditional dissonant results. But here's the deal. I'm a smoker, and smoking causes cancer aren't logical opposite statements. They don't actually contradict each other, and yet they produce all the effects of dissonance. So we're not looking at something, we're not looking at dissonance as a result of logical inconsistencies. Dissonance is the result of psychological inconsistencies. And the psychological inconsistency has to do with how we see ourselves. The reason why telling a smoker that smoking causes cancer causes them to minimize the truth of one statement or to try to come up with other ways that they're a good person, etc., etc., is because behind those two statements are the statements, I'm a smart person, no, I'm a dumb person. Or I'm a good person, no, I'm a bad person. Or the statement, I'm a competent person, no, I'm an incompetent person. This is the idea. Elliot Aronson says that dissonance is produced primarily not when we hold logical inconsistencies in our mind, but rather when our concept of self starts to get threatened. We have sort of psychological imperatives. We must be able to believe that we are competent, that we're moral, and that we're rational. And humans almost never resolve those in the other direction. They will do almost anything that they can to believe that they're competent, moral, and rational. He said, we're not rational beings, we're self-rationalizing beings. It was maybe something of a cynical way to look at it. I think there's some legitimacy there, but I think there's also, I mean, maybe that's a little over-cynical in my estimation. But this was the idea. You are, people feel the need, they have to be rational, moral, and they have to be competent. So let's review these cases, right? These students of mine. So we have this girl, she's sabotaging herself, not doing the best she can, devaluing the work that she might accomplish and what she may become, and why. I mean, it doesn't make sense on sort of a logical level for her to do that, but again, dissonance isn't logical, it's psychological. Can you see that she doesn't want to find out whether she's good at debate, because she still is operating on the premise that she can't be a moral, competent, rational person and only get 13th in a debate tournament if she's trying her best. And she's not allowed to know that. I hope you're catching the concept here. These are psychological imperatives. You have to know that. Humans have to believe that. They have to believe that they're moral, that they're rational, and that they're competent. And you can't beat it. And you're certainly not going to beat it in a teenager. You're not going to out-logic that imperative. So, no matter, you could go to her all day and be like, well, this doesn't make any sense. This is not, you should do your best. Clearly, you should do that. But you're competing against something much more primal. She has to believe that she's moral, competent, and rational. And if she thinks that in order to be moral, competent, and rational, she has to be the best one in the room, then there's nothing you can get her to do whether she's the best in the room, because it's too scary for her to do it if she suspects that, in fact, she's not. So now, the crazy behavior makes all the sense in the world. It's crazy. But it makes sense. This girl, this other girl, the one who made sure that everyone knew that she did not like this class. Shockingly, she comes back for year two. I'm like, what are you doing? I thought for sure you were not coming back for year two, but she did. She'd grown a little bit, a little quieter, wasn't complaining so much. So we have these speeches that are called oratories, and we have them write these speeches. And she's like, hey, Sam, can you help me with my oratory? And I was like, yeah. Tell me about it. What do you want to talk about? And she's like, well, I want to write a speech about how we shouldn't worry too much about what other people think about us. And then she starts crying. It's like, okay, tell me all about it. Tell me about your experience. And she was like, last year, I just lost all of my friends. I lost them all. And I was so scared because I was so worried what people thought about me. I thought I was nothing. And I'm sorry for being such a butt in your class. Like, wow, I did not see this coming. But I think I've learned that you can't worry too much about what people think about you. So you say, crazy, why are you pretending that you don't like a class that you in fact like? I mean, it's easy at this point. It stops looking like, you know, so much like, oh, do I really have to be in this class? This is so stupid. And it's more like, do we really have to be in this class, right, guys? Who's with me, right? You're with me, are you not? This is pretty stupid, don't you all think? I'm pretty cool, don't you think I'm cool? It starts to look really different. And it makes all the sense in the world. And there is, I could have gone through and been like, yeah, you know what, shape it up. In fact, you do like this class. Stop pretending that you don't. But I'm competing against imperatives so strong that they are present across human life. You can study cognitive dissonance anywhere, and it's still there, with any age group, and it's still there. She has to believe that she's competent, and that she's rational, that she's a good person, that people like her, that she belongs. And she would do anything to belong. And if that means pretending that you hate a class that you like so that you can curry favor with your classmates, then who cares? That's nothing to pay to meet your psychological imperatives. So, the point is that when you look at a kid who's apathetic, you can see a jerk, someone who is, you know, just on one, and you can try to argue them into the ground. Why don't you shape up? I don't know how many times that statement has really worked. Well, was the kid ever like, that's a good point. Why don't I just shape up? You can try to logic them into the ground. You're like, hey, this is a dumb thing that you're doing. Are they ever like, good point, Father. I agree this is a dumb thing that I am doing. Because again, dissonance is not logical, it's psychological. And what you're looking at is not bad kids, dumb kids, jerk kids. You're looking at scared kids and hurt kids. Kids who aren't sure if they're worth anything or if they're going to amount to anything. It's not an argument against strong boundaries. That's not an argument against having good rules. It's not an argument against good leadership for your child. It's an argument about how you see your child. And it's an argument about the long-term ways that you approach intractable situations with kids. I don't know. Are there bad kids out there? Are there dumb kids out there, just jerk kids? I don't know. I mean, maybe. But I've come to be convinced. I've taught thousands of kids. I teach more every year. And I honestly, I don't think I've ever met one. If they exist, I've met some kids that were really, really disruptive. I've got some kids who are really, really, really tough to teach. But I'm just not sure that I ever met a bad kid. So the question is, how do you deal with it? If you change your perspective about what you're looking at when you have a kid, how does that change how you deal with a kid? Let me tell you why I think that Elliot Aronson is too cynical. He says that we are not rational beings. We're self-rationalizing beings, and we're interested in self-justification, not truth. And he says that that's a good reason to explain political polarization and tribalism and prejudice and things like that. And I don't know, maybe there's some truth to that. But I think that that's overly cynical, because I think there's a larger truth underneath that. And that is that the reason that we rationalize is not because we're bad people but think we have to be good people. And the reason why kids, they get so intractable and they get so hard to deal with, especially in those really, really dark teen years, is not because they're bad kids but they just don't want to admit it. It's because we and they have poor definitions of what these things mean. Actually, humans are not so bad. And that kids, I mean, at the very least, the teens I've taught, they're really not so bad. Even the really, really rough ones, not so bad. So I want to do a little activity here with you. It's, I mean, not too interactive, but just in your mind primarily. And I want to make something clear here. I asked you to write your definitions down, and I'm going to say some things. It could come off as a little rough for you, potentially. And maybe not. Maybe it's all good. But maybe it's going to end up a little rough, and I want to let you know something before that starts. I don't think my definition of being a competent parent is not to be a perfect parent. I don't think that makes any sense. Competence Like, you could define competence that way. That's not a great way to define competence. It's certainly not the highest quality definition. Good parents, great parents even, they're not parents who do it right. They're parents who do it wrong and then learn and try to change and do it wrong some more and learn and try to change. And their kids live good lives not because they got it right, but because they were willing to try to get it right. Nobody gets it right. That's the point. Nobody has that luxury. Nobody gets it right. No kid, no parent. So, I hope you'll keep that in mind and not think that I, from my pedestal, am pointing any fingers, except for maybe me, because this one's rough for me too. I've got my own kids, and they've been intractable at times as well. I want you to look at your definition of these words, moral, competent, rational, and I want you to consider the implicit curriculum. The implicit curriculum is it's this idea that's developed by a researcher named Philip Jackson in the 60s, and it's this really important part of educational research. It basically says this, that there's always the explicit curriculum, the visible curriculum, the things that you teach. That's like, here, it's grammar, and here's how you structure a sentence, and here's how you find evidence, and this is a good argument. That's all explicit curriculum. But implicit curriculum is what you teach when you're not meaning to teach. It's the values you pass on. It's the ways that you, the way that things should be done. It's your viewpoint on the world. It's your worldview. And the implicit curriculum always gets passed on. This is the point of the implicit curriculum. It always gets passed on. There's no such thing as a null implicit curriculum because every teacher has their values. Every teacher has their way of seeing. And in ways that you cannot predict, you pass those on. Little things that you don't know that you're doing, and ways that you reinforce behaviors, and that's just as true for parents as it is for teachers. We pass on what we believe to kids, and that includes the way that we define important terms in this world, like what it means to be a moral person, what it means to be a competent person, what it means to be a rational person. So, take a look at your definition. Let's imagine that your child believed it. They looked at your definition and they believed you. You passed it on and you said, this is what it means to be competent. And they said, good. That is what it means to be competent. Yes, Mom and Dad, I agree with you. Here's my question. Does your child get to be human and competent at the same time? If that's the definition. If your definition of competent was to do things right, and that's the best definition, then the reality is your child doesn't get to be human and competent at the same time. And so they get stuck in this terrible tearing apart between their cognitive imperatives and their reality. They know that they're not competent, but their mind tells them they must be. And in that place, is it any wonder that they say, well, screw it, I don't care anymore. Because I can't do it anymore. I can't be that person that I'm supposed to be. Do they get to be rational? If rational means you're right, is it any wonder that they get into class and then they're like, I can't give this answer. I can't try. Because then maybe I'll get it wrong. Again, I hope that this is not overly hard. I look at myself and I say, oh man, there are lots of things I wish I could have done better with my kids. Good news. Kids continue to learn well into life. I mean, you are learning, I am learning. So we have lots of ability to change the way that we think about these things and we talk to our children, the way we express this to them. Here's the idea though. What if we were able to express to them definitions of these words that were more of a more mature nature, of layered in with more meaning? Look, it's fine. You say to a kid, what does it mean to be competent? Well, I'll tell you what it means to be competent. Well, it means that you're good at stuff. But let me tell you what it even more means to be competent. What it really means to be competent the most important competency you can gain is the ability to say, wow, I don't know everything, and I don't do it right all the time, and I'm okay with that. I just want to keep trying. That's the most competent person in the room. The most competent person in the room is not the person who can do it right, because that person can do it now, but can they do it later? Competency changes over time, but it really only changes if we can accept that we are bad at stuff, and then we get good at stuff, and that's the rule of human life. You always have to be bad at stuff before you're good at stuff. And the most competent person in the room knows that. The question is, how could you, in a steady drumbeat, in that implicit curriculum, the way that you live your life, the way you talk to your children, the way that you run a classroom, how do you message that? This is the question that you should consider. How do we beat that drum? The most competent person in the room is the person who is willing to admit that they don't know what's going on and go from there. If your definition of what it means to be rational is that you're right, maybe you might consider a definition that says, here's the most rational person in the room. The most rational person in the room recognizes that humans don't always get to be right. It's not how life works. This is what Socrates says, right? He says, I was deemed the wisest by the oracle, and I couldn't figure out why, until I considered the idea that the only reason I might be the wisest is because I thought I knew the least. What if your child really bought that thought? Like, really bought that thought? You could express it to them to the point that they really thought, I actually am being rational and intelligent when I say, I don't know. What do you think? Help me understand that. It is rational for me to try. Here's my best answer. That's what rational looks like. If they really change their mind, can you see how that would affect them in whether or not they say, I don't care. This is stupid anyway. Who wanted this dumb class in the first place? And if you say moral, what if we were to say that the most moral person in the room, maybe in a, it's hard to say that ever, judgment belongs to God, but maybe in a worldly sense, that the most moral person in the room is the person who can say, I was wrong, and I'm sorry. That's what morality really is the ability to say, I was wrong, and I'm sorry. Because none of us get to be perfectly moral. It just doesn't happen. So this is my encouragement for you, is to consider this question. How can we beat that drum? How do we respond when our child makes a mistake? How we respond when they give us a bad answer? Do we say, hey, we already went over this? Or do we say, I really appreciate that you're not giving up on this, and inside you're like, I cannot believe we're going over this one more time! I'm going to go crazy if I have to do this math problem one more time! But on the outside, you say, I'm really proud of you for sticking with this. I mean, I think this is what it means to be good at math, is that you stick with it. So, great job. When they come home and they've done something really stupid, you know, do you say, you screwed up so bad, and that's the first thing they hear? Or do you say, I love you, I'm glad you're safe. And I think the fact that you're talking to me about this is really good. Thank you for being honest, and let's talk about how we make this better. This is the question. How can you beat that drum? My time is up. It's been so much a pleasure to talk to you. I hope that you have found something valuable. But I guess to wrap up, I'll just say this. It's about changing the way that you see your child, and it's the way we see children. Instead of seeing with those intractable kids who don't care, instead of seeing screw-ups, instead of seeing lazy kids, we see hurt kids, we see scared kids, We see kids who get caught between the fact that they have to feel like they're a good person, but they know they're not perfect. They have to feel like they're intelligent, but they know that they mess up. They have to feel like they're competent, but they can't do everything. And helping them feel like that's okay. Essentially, seeing humans and letting them know that it's okay to be human. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time. Hope you have a good day. Head out in the hall.
Thank you.
I sometimes say it. Time to play.